keep yourselves from idols.
Little children, keep yourselves from idols. 1 John 5:21. I thought I'd take something that was a little lighter, but still very, very necessary. And the Apostle John's words here are very, very needful to us. You know, the Apostle John was aged and he was serene. He was, he'd become a legend in the church. He was on the scene from the very earliest time when he became a disciple of Jesus Christ. And here he was, an old man, probably 95 or so years, full of experience and full of the beautiful relationships that he had had and enjoyed. He became kind of like the darling of the church because not only was he a church historian, he knew everything that happened from the beginning to the end, but he had a wonderful mind, almost total recall. You must realize that when he wrote the Epistle of John, he wrote that in his very, very old age. He was probably in his 90s or more, maybe 95, something like that. We don't know the exact year, but he was very old. And when you stop to think that John was written, the Gospel of John was written, chapter 13, 14, 15, 16, 17 were written by the apostle with total recall. The 17th chapter of John was written verbatim of Jesus' prayer. This was, you know, 50 years or more past the time when he had heard it. So he was just a remarkable person. He was the darling of the churches because, not because he was an idol, but because he was a legend among them. He was a messenger of that period of the church. And not only that, but, you know, when he became an old man, too infirm to even walk a great deal, the young brethren would carry him up to the front of the room, and he would then address the congregation as little children. Not that he claimed to be their father or anything like that, but because of his aged condition and because of the differences in their ages, he could be, as it were, a guide to them as a teacher of a classroom of children. Now, also, he was the last apostolic link. You know, the early church clung to the apostles, because the apostles had all the information that related to Jesus Christ. You know, if you wanted to know what happened here or there, where would you go? Well, you would go to the person that walked with Jesus and learned of him. That's what they were supposed to do for the time that they were with Jesus on his days on earth. Well, John was one of those that stayed a little nearer to Jesus than all the other apostles. And on top of that, because of John, we know what we would not have known. John was the only apostle that had the courage to stay with Jesus through the six trials on his last night, into the morning. He probably left for maybe 45 minutes or an hour while Jesus was carrying the cross. He went to tell the other disciples. And so he left for a season. He went to tell them that Jesus was going to be crucified. Then he ran back with the women. He told them, and Mary was told that her son was going to be crucified. So they all went back, and John ran back. So he was there at the cross. He was the only apostle to witness the crucifixion of Jesus. So, in other words, the apostle John knew more about Jesus' life, personally than any of the other apostles. Plus one additional factor we have to put in. Remember from the cross, Jesus said to John, to Mary, "Woman, behold thy son." And to John he said, "Behold thy mother." And so from that day, John took Mary, the mother of Jesus, into his house. And don't you think that this was a great blessing to John, because she could confirm to John all of the experiences that she had with her son during those 36 years of her relationship with him. So John became the depositor of all the information that was collected from Mary. And so she told them these little stories, apparently, before, we don't know when she died, but before she died, I'm sure she had a catalog of experiences that she gave to John. And so John, you know, it must have been a great joy for the church to hear him, as he would tell the little stories about Jesus, and stories that maybe they didn't hear before, that he had picked up from Mary or from his own experience. He became a kind of a legend, a historian of all the little nitty-gritty details of Jesus' life. So he became, as it were, a historian. He was, we remember how he could tie the past and the present together in a way that none of the other apostles could, because he was blessed in that particular way of being on the scene and having all these extra special experiences that made him a repository of a great deal of information that perhaps none of the others had firsthand. They may have gotten it secondhand. All right. Also, he could tell of the history of the church. He lived long enough to tell about the initial persecution that took place at Jerusalem, and how the church was scattered, and that the apostles still kept Jerusalem as the hub of the wheel. But then finally he could tell of the destruction of the city of Jerusalem. He could tell all of these things that happened. So he became a historian of fact because of his longevity. He lived through all of this period. He saw the Church of Jerusalem, which was the hub of the whole Christian era, destroyed, and how it had to rework to find its organization again, because it was organized around Jerusalem. And when that ended, they had to kind of reorganize. So John had that ability. Also, he had a brilliant mind. He had an artist's eye. He told the little details that others left out. You know, others said that, Peter cut off the servant of the high priest's ear. When John tells it, he tells it the name of the servant of the high priest. He says it's Malcolm, and he says it was his right ear. He gives you the little details, and that's why he was used for the revelation of Jesus Christ, which he received on the Isle of Patmos. And then it was said of him that he was released, and he went to visit the seven actual churches that were maybe around 230 miles round trip to visit all these churches, and he conveyed this information to them. All right, now we have the first four commandments. The first one in Exodus 20, verse 3, "You shall have no other gods before me." The lesson is that there is no replacement for God in our hearts and lives now and forever. It is God above all, always, now and forever. Yes, above even the tenderest earthly tie, even above anyone we may love as our own soul. Still, it is God above all. Nothing may dilute our singular worship of God, and we owe him our complete devotion and untiring allegiance and steadfast love. That is embodied in this first commandment. The second one is you shall make for yourselves, you shall not make for yourselves a graven image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above. You see, even art was forbidden. That's one of the lament of the artist world, the cultured world. They say, well, you know, it's so unfortunate that the Jews didn't have a great catalog of artwork to contribute. They don't have the wonderful artworks that the Vatican has. But God did not permit that. You see, what happens, art and religion, the trouble with art and religion is that it replaces religion. And pretty soon, you're wondering, what did the artist mean when he drew this? And I wonder this about the artist and that about the artist. And pretty soon, you're talking about the artist and you're forgetting about the creator or the thing that he is trying to illustrate. So the Lord did not want anyone to make any drawings or anything that would represent him. The third commandment, you shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain. And we know that the name of the Lord was holy. It could not be used in a light way or in banter of any kind. It had to be kept sacred. And we know that the Jews were very, very disciplined about that. Even when they wrote the Bible, when they were scribes writing, when they wrote the word, the tetragram, J-H-W-H, Yahweh, in the Hebrew, they don't put the vowels in. You have to supply them. So the tetragram, J-H-W-H, normally would have appeared about 7,000 times in the Old Testament. But they didn't like to do that, because when they wrote that, they would usually burn the pen because it was sacred. It was used to write that holy name. So they began to use the word Lord instead of the tetragram. And that was, the Jews didn't use it because it was too sacred to use. Even when they use the word God, they leave out the vowel O, it's G-D. That's the way they represent it. But to the Christians, they came along, and that was wonderful that God and Jesus, the name Lord was used, so they could interchange God and Lord Jesus and make them appear one. And so the reader has often been denied the fact that the word Yahweh appears 7,000 times in the Old Testament. And the fourth commandment, remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. We are to rest with God. All right, now we want to talk about gross immorality, just quickly. They had Baal worship in 1 Kings 16:32 and 33. We read that Ahab reared an altar for Baal in the house of Baal. That was bad. Then Amos 5:26, ye have borne the tabernacle of your Moloch and Shion, your images, the star of your God, which ye made to yourselves. So this was a common practice among the Israelites as their devotion to God declined. They began to worship false gods. And we're even surprised when we get to 1 Kings 11:5, we find that Solomon, who wrote a good part of, not a good part, but a part of our Bible, who wrote a lot of wonderful and beautiful things, when he became old, he became foolish. And we read of in 1 Kings 11:5, Solomon went after Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Zidonians, and after Milcom, the abomination of the Ammonites. And that's why we don't believe that Solomon would be an ancient worthy. We don't have any scripture to support it, but I don't know of any other ancient worthy that made provisions for demon worship. That's a sad, sad state for Solomon to fall into when he began to make provisions for these demonic gods. All right, then we know some of the things that happened in Israel's history. We remember that when the kingdom was rent from Rehoboam and God gave Jeroboam 10 tribes, God told Jeroboam, I will establish you on your throne. He made him promises almost equivalent to David. You'll have someone on your throne forever if you obey me. Well, it didn't happen that way, because the first thing, when Jeroboam was made king of the 10-tribe kingdom, he had a big worry. God had placed him into office, but there was a big problem. The Jews were commanded to worship where? At Jerusalem. And that was the 2-tribe kingdom, where Rehoboam was. And he thought, oh, if I let these people go up to the 2-tribe kingdom to worship at Jerusalem, why, the heart of the people is going to go to Rehoboam, and they're going to kill me. They won't need me. They'll say, why do we need the 10-tribe kingdom? Let's go back to Rehoboam. So he had a plan. And the plan was that he would make 2 golden calves. He would put one at Bethel and one at Dan, and he would that way keep the children of Israel tied in with worship there. And he even made a priesthood to serve, and it would be convenient. They didn't have to go up to Jerusalem. They could worship right there at Bethel or at Dan, and didn't have to make a pilgrimage to Jerusalem. And so we see how their minds began to work. They couldn't exercise faith in God, and so they began to make plans, devious plans, to keep control of the minds and hearts of the people. And the same thing happened early on in the golden calf that Aaron made. Remember, they had agreed to worship God. They had agreed to these 10 commandments, but they had violated the first 3 commandments, and it took them only how many days to do that? 40 days. They made this agreement, and 40 days later, guess what? They were dancing around a golden calf, and they said, these be the gods that brought thee out of this, these be the gods, O Israel, which brought thee up out of the land of Egypt. Now, Aaron, he made the golden calf, but he tried to use a little bit of applied psychology, and he lost. He said, well, if you want a golden calf, yeah, give me your earrings and your gold. And he thought maybe that would discourage them. But no, to his surprise, the gold came in piles. He had plenty of gold to make the golden calf. And so then, after he cast it, he wanted to compromise. He wanted to have one foot on one side of the fence and the other foot on the other side of the fence. And so he said, tomorrow is the feast of the Lord Jehovah, as they were worshiping the golden calf. Now, you figure that out. But you see what the mind begins to do. He wanted to, in a way, cling to the worship of Jehovah, but because of the pressure of the people, he wanted to give them the golden calf. And you can't do that, can you? It was an extremely costly mistake. It almost cost the nation of Israel their life. And we are told in Deuteronomy that God was so angry at Aaron that he wanted to kill him. He was so angry with Aaron that he wanted to kill him, but Moses interceded for the nation, and he interceded for Aaron, and so finally Aaron became the high priest of Israel. But that was a grievous, grievous mistake. All right, let's look at some more refined images. There was Gideon's golden ephod. Remember, the nation of Israel was captive, and the Lord raised up Gideon to be a judge and a savior for them. And he delivered them. He conquered the enemy, and he freed the people, and the people came to him in Judges 8:22 and 23, and they wanted to make him ruler. And notice what a wonderful man he was. He said, I will not rule over you, neither shall my son rule over you. The Lord shall rule over you. It was a wonderful speech. Oh, to God that he really believed it. That was disingenuous on his part. Because then he turns around and says, well, wait, you know, I'm not going to rule over you, but I tell you what you could do. we've collected some gold in battle, and if you have some earrings or whatever, you could make a golden ephod and put that there as a memory of this battle and so on. And so it was really false humility. He did want a little monument built for himself. And so he had this little golden ephod made. And they made it. And we read in Judges 8:27, guess what? As soon as they made something material, it says, all Israel went thither a-whoring after it, which thing became a snare to Gideon and to his house. You see, it was that afterthought. Oh, I won't reign over you. Oh, no, not me. Neither my sons. We're going to let the Lord reign over you. But, hey, oh, by the way, you know, maybe a little golden ephod would be all right. Don't you see the working of the human mind there? And pretty soon that golden ephod became a snare to the children of Israel, and they were worshiping it. And they even used the Ark of the Covenant as a kind of a rabbit's foot to save them from their misconduct. In 1 Samuel 4, verses 3 to 10, you know, the Philistines had come and battled against the Israelites, and there was quite a number of them, and so they thought, well, the battle doesn't look too good for us. What we'll do is we'll take the Ark of the Covenant. We'll carry that onto the battlefield, and the Lord wouldn't allow anything to happen to the battle to the Ark of the Covenant. So therefore, we're going to use this Ark of the Covenant. We're going to force God to fight on our behalf and save us and the Ark of the Covenant. Guess what? The thing that they thought was impossible happened. The Philistines, when they saw the ark, they at first were discouraged. They said, oh, that's that holy article of the Israelites. We're doomed. We're going to lose this battle. But then someone said, well, we're men. Let's fight as men. And, you know, they started to fight, and they carried the day, and they carried away the Ark of the Covenant. That's because they were using this in an improper way. This represented God's presence among them, and they lost that, and they lost God's presence or witness among them. Okay, then we find there was another image that was made. You know, good King Hezekiah. He removed, we read in 2 Kings 18:4, Hezekiah removed the high places and break the images and cut down the groves and break in pieces the brazen serpent that Moses had made. For unto those days the children of Israel did burn incense to it, and they called it Nehushtan. So now, among the things that Hezekiah, good King Hezekiah, had to destroy, guess what, was, remember the incident where the children of Israel were being bitten by fiery serpents and they were dying, and they came to Moses in great distress, and what will we do? And so he went to the Lord, and the Lord said, make a copper serpent and put it on a pole, and anyone that's bitten by the snakes, just look at this copper serpent, and you will be healed. You will not die. Well, it was commanded to be made by the Lord for a certain time, for a certain purpose, but when that time ended and there were no more serpents, what were they doing? They began to use it as an article to worship. And it became idolatrous to them. Even though it was something commanded to be made by the Lord, it was the wrong thing. It had served a certain purpose, and it was not to be worshipped. It was to be looked to when they were bitten by the serpents, and that was the end of its usefulness. But they turned it around, and they made it into an idol. And therefore, it had to be smashed like some of the other idols that Hezekiah smashed. And then there's idols of another kind. You know, the biggest idol sometimes is ourselves and our ambitions. They get in the way of the worship of the true and living God. Remember how that the Lord told Hezekiah that he would die. And he wasn't too happy with that information, and he wept and he cried before the Lord. And he said, Lord, I've served you, and I've done this and that. And he recalled some of the wonderful things that he did, and he did a lot of wonderful things. Well, so the Lord said, all right, I'll extend your life 15 years. 15 years. He wanted some proof, and you know how the Lord gave him the proof that he would have 15 more years. And he was assured of the fact that he would have this extra time. Wonderful. But in that time, the Lord revealed to Hezekiah that he had some serious flaws in his character. When the princes of Babylon heard that Hezekiah was ill and was recovered, they came down with all their stately presence, with all their gold and silver and all their excellence. They came as a royal entourage to visit Hezekiah. Well, he felt flattered by this. And so what did he do? Well, he did the wrong thing. Absolutely. He was so impressed with their visit and the stature of the men that came to visit him that he wanted to show them that there was some stature here in Israel, too. He showed them all the wonderful things that he had built, the wonderful aqueduct and all the wonderful things that were accomplished in Jerusalem. He didn't hide anything from them. He showed them everything to give them an insight into the glory of the Hezekiah kingdom. So it wasn't long till Isaiah came knocking on his door, and he said, you know, these princes from Babylon, what did you show them? Oh, I showed them everything. Oh, well, everything you showed them, they were nothing but spies, you know. And they were buttering you up. Everything you showed them, they're going to come and take. But because you've been a good king heretofore, we won't let it happen in your day. But we see that he had a weakness in his character, didn't he? And when they used a little flattery, they got extracted from him information that he should not have given them. All right, now we come to another matter, and that is proper veneration. We realize that certain things shouldn't be done, but is there a place for veneration among God's people? Yes. We remember in Genesis 18:2-4, when the three angels visited Abraham, he didn't know necessarily that they were angels, because we are told that he entertained angels unawares. But he did run to meet them. He didn't just, you know, casually receive them. He ran to meet them. He bowed down before them to the ground. He offered them his hospitality, but he didn't send a servant out to pick one of the animals to be used for dinner. He went and picked it out himself. Everything that pertained to his hospitality to these wonderful guests, he took care of personally himself, and he went to Sarah's tent and made sure that Sarah baked the bread for these hosts. And we notice that Abraham had to only offer his hospitality once. Once. And the angel said, fine, we'll accept it. But we notice the difference when it came, two angels came to visit Lot. Lot didn't run to meet the angels or the two men. He stood up. Oh, he showed respect, but he didn't bow down to them. And he offered them a feast. But they said, no, thank you. We don't need a feast. And, he said, stay in our house. No, we'll lodge in the street. And, Lot had to plead with them to accept his hospitality. He finally prevailed. But we see a difference, don't we, between the two. Abraham had such a close relationship with the three angels that, yes, they accepted his hospitality spontaneously. But with Lot, he had to plead with them to accept his hospitality. And you know the events of the night. And how the Lord, the two angels, had to literally grab him by the hand and drag him out of the city. Because it was like a dream and he couldn't realize what was happening. And even when the Lord told him that he shouldn't turn back, that his wife turned back, and he was told to flee into the mountain, and he turns around and says, well, no, I don't want to go into the mountain. How about this little city? It's just a little city. Imagine the angel shock at Lot's boldness. In heaven, when God tells anyone to do something, they do it. They don't countermand God and say, when he says go to the mountain, they don't say, well, I want to go into the city. But Lot, we see, was a picture of the great company, and he said, well, let's go into the little city. And then we find later that he is in the mountain where the Lord sent him. He did not have the same reverence for the Lord. All right. Then we notice that the story of Daniel in the sixth chapter of Daniel 10 to 23. We have the story of his devotion to God. When the edict was made that no one could ask any petition of any god or man for 30 days, save of thee, O king, he shall be cast into the den of lions. Daniel 6:7. Now, this was a test put upon Daniel that he could have compromised and no one would have known it. Every day when he prayed, he opened his windows and he opened them toward Jerusalem, and he prayed loudly so everyone could hear him from this window. He prayed loudly toward Jerusalem. But when the edict was made, he could have left the windows shut and he could have reclined a little further back and whispered his prayer. Matter of fact, we're told to go into our closet where no one can see us and to pray. But they were told at that time and place to pray toward Jerusalem. So Daniel would not alter his habits. The same thing he did yesterday, he did today under this new edict. And they were all waiting outside the window of Daniel to hear him pray toward the God in Jerusalem. And we know the story. The king knew that he was trapped. He was very unhappy that Daniel was going to be the one to be thrown in the lion's den. We are told that he labored all day trying to save Daniel. He was angry that they had outwitted him and they had gotten him maneuvered into a position of, by his own pride, to actually be in a position now where he would have to kill his beloved servant Daniel. He decided there was no alternative. The law of the Medes and the Persians was such that you couldn't change it. Once it was there, even the king could not change the edict. So he had Daniel thrown into the lion's den, and we know the story. He came in the morning and said, O Daniel, art thou there? And Daniel said, O king, live forever. And he was delivered. All right, so we see that there was a difference, though, between the experience of Daniel and the three Hebrews. Now, theirs was a shotgun approach. They were told that they must bow down before this image or they would be destroyed. That's the shotgun approach. See, Daniel didn't have a shotgun approach. He was told that he couldn't worship any other god, but he could have done it quietly. He could have maneuvered and compromised so that he wouldn't have to do it as he normally did. But he didn't choose to do that. He wanted it known that his worship of God was going to be consistent, irrespective of what the edict was. He proceeded as though there were no edict. But the three Hebrews, they not only were commanded to worship this image that had been put up, but we are told that the king was furious with them and that he wanted He was so angry that he ordered the fire heated up 7 times. And we know the story there, how that they were delivered. Okay, then we come to our theme text. Keep yourselves from idols. Now, we cannot fault John for his endearing relationship with the brethren. One of the beautiful things that I learned in studying this, it's a little secret I'm going to tell you. And I don't know if you knew it before. I never knew it for many, many, many years. But I was overjoyed to find this. It's just a little thing, but yet it's a remarkable thing. In the Gospel of John, guess what? He never refers to himself as I. He does not use the word I to represent himself in that entire gospel. He does in his epistles, he does in Revelation, because I represents the John class, but in the Gospel of John, he never uses the word I. I don't know of any other book of the Bible that's true of, but that's true of the Gospel of John. When he refers to himself, he does it in an ambiguous way. He'd say the disciple that Jesus loved, and if you didn't know who it was, you wouldn't know who it was, but this is how he managed to get around the word I. And that was a beautiful thought, because, you know, one of the most overused words in the world today is I. Everybody's I first. And so John kept himself out of the I picture. Now, even from the first epistle of John, we see that he was in locked combat with Antichrist forces who denied Jesus had come in the flesh. And John had to, not only he was the darling of many of the brethren, but he was also the enemy of the Antichrist who were in the church. They didn't like John. And there was a certain man by the name of Cerinthus of John's time who preached Jesus was a just man, whom at baptism became possessed by Christ from heaven, and that Christ left Jesus just before he died on the cross. Now, this was Greek philosophy that was starting to enter in, and this is where you have the beginning of such things as the Trinity concept, because and it came from demonic sources, because it gave the impression that there was a man named Jesus who became possessed by a heavenly spirit, and that this spirit left him before he was crucified, but that Jesus Christ was just an ordinary man. And it harks back to the days of the demons and the angels, when they materialized and they dematerialized, and this was entering into Greek philosophy and was being pushed into the Christian church. All right. Then we read in Revelation 19:10 that I fell at his feet and worshipped him, and he said unto me, See thou do it not, I am thy fellow servant, and of thy brethren that have the testimony of Jesus, worship God, for the testimony of Jesus is the spirit of prophecy. And some say that, well, here is something that the Lord's people are doing. They've made an idol of this one at whom John is falling at his feet to worship, which many have said was Pastor Russell in our time. And we believe probably that that was true in this vision, that he represented that. And the answer that he was given, see that thou do it not. He wasn't accused of being an idolater, but he was told not to do it, but to worship God. I am thy fellow servant. And that was how Brother Russell always, or most of the time, signed his letters. Your brother. And guess what? Fellow servant. And so we think that it's proper to show respect for the messenger, but not in place of God, but as a servant of the true and living God. You know, one of the things that Brother Russell used to call the pilgrims to task on more than any single issue was that Brother Russell would call in the pilgrims that he personally sent out, and one of the things that he would tell them when they got into his office, he said, "I want less preaching of Brother Russell, and I want more preaching of the truth." So it was Brother Russell's clear design that he did not want brethren going around preaching, "Brother Russell, Brother Russell, Brother Russell." He said, "Preach the truth." And that is the proper spirit. All right, now we see that also in this statement that the spirit of Jesus is the spirit is the spirit of testimony of Jesus. The spirit of prophecy is the testimony of Jesus. The fact that prophecy may be hard to understand and that we have made mistakes in reading it past and probably will make our share in the future. Yes, most of us through the years have been nicked in our understanding. I know that when I was a young man, I thought that if you had told me that I would be here in 2001 in Detroit, I would have said, "I don't think so, brother or sister." But it didn't work out the way we thought back then. So, yes, we've learned from our mistakes, and we keep trying to learn from our mistakes, but we should not give up on prophecy because we misjudged and misread certain things. Now, idols in the church. Sometimes we think that only the Catholics have idols in their churches, and of course they do, but they don't think they do. They say, "Well, we don't worship the idols. The idols are just the means of reminding us of something higher and something better, and so we don't really pray to this image, but actually it's only a representation of something." And so that's their way of getting themselves off the hook. Now, idols do not have to be, they don't have to be made of stone or of painted or something like that. Idols can be whatever we make them. When we look back at the experiences of Israel, we find a tendency to leave the worship of the true and living God in some form of idolatry. And some of us would say, "Well, I would never be tempted to do anything like that." Yes, but they were tempted to do things like that. And it comes to us in more subtle form. Brother Russell tells of a brother who rejoiced in the truth for a season. However, he had a wife that was very antagonistic to the truth, and she found it galling that he gave so much of his time and his influence to the truth. And finally she had it up to here with him, and she said, "Look, you're going to have to choose between me and your religion." So what did he do? He chose his wife, and he stopped going to the meetings, and the sequel of the story was that he later became very ill. And guess what? His wife left him. Now he didn't have his wife, and he didn't have the truth. And so he made a mistake. Now, we don't know how he finished his course. Maybe he sought the Lord's face again and came back into some measure of favor, but whatever happened. But we see that he had allowed someone to step between him and his worship of the true and living God. And it's not only within the church, but we know that in the world, and even our Christian friends in the churches, they're troubled with the influence of the world upon some of their leading members. You know, we're living in a time where the mystical company will take a Christian into its vaunted halls of power and show that person the great ladder that leads upward, higher to success, up to to the very top. And they will take a Christian in and they will say, well, you know, see this ladder? You could be up there at the top. All you have to do is become a dedicated member of this corporation and give yourself fully to it. And it may be a genuine offer, but they want your time, they want your strength, they want your mental resources day and night. And that can be tantalizing to a Christian. A Christian can say, well, I'll do this for a season, then I'll get my golden egg, and when I get it all, then I will serve the Lord. But we know that it doesn't work that way. Those who have been enchanted to be part of the company and have risen up through the ranks sometimes are quite taken back to find out that when they get there, it isn't what they thought it should be, or it doesn't give them the satisfaction they thought it would. Or perhaps many who got up through lesser rungs, they found out that when the times get tough, what happens? All these secondary and third layers of management, what happens to them? It's out the door. And by the way, don't let the door hit you on the way out. That's the way they treat people. And so people who have given themselves to the company sometimes are heartbroken when suddenly they find that they were only being used and exploited. And when they got whatever they wanted out of them, it's out the door. And so one of the idols can be wealth. 1 Timothy 6:9-10, we read, those who desire to be rich fall into temptation and into a snare, into many senseless and hurtless desires that plunge men into ruin and destruction, for the love of money is the root of all evil. Have you ever thought how nice it would be if you could have a windfall of a million or two, and you wouldn't have to do this or that, and you could serve the Lord and do all these wonderful things? Well, the Lord isn't testing us on whether we have a million or two. He's testing us, what is that in my hand? That's where we're being tested. And we should not covet what we do not have. Whatever the Lord chooses to give us, if we have a million, we're going to find that it's going to be harder to be faithful over a million than it is over $10 in our pocket. Because, you know, $10 isn't a whole lot. The widow had only two mites, and it wasn't so hard for her to drop the two mites in the box. But could you imagine the rich man dropping everything that he had into the box? It'd be a lot harder to do. And so it's very difficult to be faithful over much. It's easier to be faithful over little. I'm reminded of the story of Emile Zola of France. He, in his youth, knew poverty and became an idealist, espousing the cause of the poor against the privileged classes. And he wrote many books. Emile Zola became a great writer, and he was a darling of the poor and the underprivileged people of France. But something happened along the way. And Emile Zola's books became very popular, and they were selling like hotcakes, and the royalties were coming into Emile Zola, and he was no longer the poor man. He became a very wealthy man, and pretty soon he was out of league with those that he was in fellowship with before. And, you know, the ideals that he espoused, that he was against, he was living the life of the rich, and he was becoming less desirable to his former friends. All right, that's why perhaps the wise man said, give me neither poverty or riches. Feed me with food convenient for me, lest I be full and deny thee. Also, we read in Luke 16:15, Jesus said to the Pharisees, ye are they which justify yourselves before men, but God knoweth your hearts. For that which is highly esteemed among men is an abomination in the sight of God. Well, that's quite a strong statement. That which is highly esteemed among men is an abomination to God. Well, the ones that he was addressing this to were the religious leaders the people that loved the praise of God more, or the praise of men more than they did the praise of God. You know, they didn't want to be holy men. They wanted to be considered holy men. And there's quite a difference, isn't there? They wanted to make long prayers in the streets, and people go by and say, oh, look at that holy man. What a wonderful man he is. How devout, how beautiful. The fact was that they weren't holy men. They behaved in a most unholy way, but it was disingenuous. It was a whole play act that they were putting on to collect recognition that they didn't really deserve. And so it was hypocrisy in action. And what is it that people want? You know, great sacrifices are made in this world. Politicians, you know, sometimes you feel sorry for them, what they have to subject themselves to get to the place where they want to go. They have to be willing to have their name vilified and every little small detail of their life splashed and exaggerated and misrepresented on the pages of the news. They have to be put upon and live in a glass bowl before the world. And it's quite embarrassing and painful to them. But why do they do it? Oh, they do it because they want a place in history. If they could just have their name emblazoned in history for a day or two, a place in the sun for an hour or two, that's what they want. This is what is an abomination in the sight of the Lord. They want recognition. They want power. They want influence, even if it's for a moment. Everyone knows that even if you get into the sun, it's only there for 10 minutes. Pretty soon the sun moves on and you're in the shadows. And they know that. But still, they lust to have that power, that influence, even if it's for a moment. Well, dear friends, if that is in the background of our desires, if that's what we are seeking, if in our service of the Lord of the truth, then, of course, we are disingenuous in our relationship with the Lord, and we are being poorly motivated, evilly motivated. And that would be a form of idolatry. If our service of the brethren is motivated by a desire for recognition, for fame, or for glory, while we serve the Lord, then we are making a serious mistake. Recognition may be our only reward. If we get our reward in this life, we don't need to look for anything more in the afterlife. How carefully we must watch our hearts. It is easy to sing, oh, to be nothing, nothing. It's another thing to live a life that demonstrates we are willing to be nothing, nothing. There's a big spread between the two. And that is and should be the desire of our hearts, but it does not come easily. For us to be nothing means we have to be willing to step down. We have to be willing to be put down. We have to be willing to endure opposition and persecution and whatever it requires. And so that should not be an idol for any of the Lord's people. We should serve the Lord with fear and trembling. And then there's idols of sect and organization, our church group or whatever it is. You know, I don't know whether it was Latimer or Ridley or which one of the martyrs. He first, when he was going to be put to the stake, he recanted. And then later, after he recanted again. And he was sorry that he had denied the Lord, but he was willing to go to the stake the second time. And the second time, when they were about ready to light the fire to the faggots under his feet, he turned to those in the group that was surrounding him, and he said, if I had served my God as well as I had served my church, I would have been consumed before this hour. And that may be true of each one of us. If we would serve our God as sincerely, with such fidelity above, you know, God above all. That's what the Lord is looking for in his people. Now, the truth movement of this harvest time was spared from trying to reform the churches, but was commissioned to perform another work, to call his people out of Babylon. And so that's been a happier work. Instead of trying to reform, we just call those that have a hearing ear to come out. And, you know, all we have to do is preach the truth, and what does the Lord say? My sheep hear my voice, and another they will not follow. And so our duty, the duty of every member of the Lord's congregation, of the Lord's people, is to continue to preach the truth, to uphold the truth, to serve the truth, and that will be our service. Just like God asked Peter, do you love me? Peter says, yes, you know that I love you. And then what did Jesus say? Feed my sheep. And so we must continue to hold the truth before the brethren. The best message that we have, we must hold before them. And that will be our highest service at this time, because we know that the true sheep will hear his voice, and another they will not follow. In closing, we would like to read from John 5:19, 21, kind of like where we started, that's where we want to end. We know that we are of God, and the whole world is in the power of the evil one. And that's the only reason that we're not under the power of the evil one, is because we are of God. And we know that the Son of God has come and has given us understanding to know him who is true. And we are in him who is true, in his Son, Jesus Christ. This is the true God and eternal life. Little children, keep yourselves from idols. Amen.